Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. You know that performance counts, so put your pension in the hands of our experts. Talk to a financial broker about a Zurich pension today.
Now to international news, and US President Donald Trump says something good may be happening on the talks to end war in Ukraine after his administration's peace plan was, in their own words, updated following Ukraine-US talks in Geneva. Now, meanwhile, the European Commission, while noting constructive progress, announced a coalition of the willing will meet tomorrow as it races to finalise a reparation loans for Kyiv. Well, I'm joined on the line now by Suzanne Lynch, Brussels Bureau Chief for Bloomberg, and also by David Smith, Washington Bureau Chief for The Guardian. Good evening to you both. David, to you first. Initially, there had been pressure on for Ukraine to have signed up to this by Thursday. President Trump says there may be good news on the horizon. I suppose the question is, good news for whom?
Well, indeed. And if it had been the original 28-point plan, then that was great news for Vladimir Putin, who would have got to pretty much everything he wanted. And we've heard in Washington, some Democratic senators, for example, describe that as a sort of Neville Chamberlain-style peace in our time document. But there does appear to be better news for Ukraine in the last 24 hours or so during these negotiations, with some of the most hardline demands removed, reportedly, from the latest talks in terms of, that original plan described Ukraine withdrawing from cities in the eastern Donbass region, limiting the size of its army, committing not to join NATO. And now, according to media accounts, the latest plan would have no recognition of land seized by the Russian military. Ukraine could make its own decisions on whether to join the European Union and NATO. But all of that said, officially, Marco Rubio was giving very little away during his press conferences yesterday, not wanting to affect this one way or the other. And everyone agrees there's still quite some distance to go.
And has any amendment to the 28-point plan, insofar as we know there is any, has that come on foot of some of the pushback within Donald Trump's own Republican Party, which has been in some quarters quite strong, particularly targeting the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio?
Yeah, I think that could be a factor here. And Rubio may be the most important figure of all. Traditionally, of course, he was a Russia hawk. And there have been various instances this year when he's reined Trump in a bit. For example, after that meeting in Alaska with Putin, Rubio was the one emphasizing that this is far from settled. And he seemed to intervene to prevent a second Trump-Putin meeting. And now he clearly seems to be taking the lead instead of Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, here, and giving the Ukrainians more leeway. And yes, I think it does also reflect some pressure from Republicans, many of whom have never been particularly favorable to Russia, and all of whom, just start to see glimpses of weakness in Donald Trump over the Epstein files, over his push to scrap the filibuster, over various other things. They're all aware that Trump is in his final term, and they are looking to a post-Trump future.
What is motivating the particular stance by the White House? Heretofore, and under Joe Biden, arms were being given to Ukraine. Now arms are being sold to Ukraine and paid for by Europe. I mean, even on that basic economic transactional end of things, the US is gaining from this. So why is Donald Trump so keen to wrap it up?
Yeah, I mean, I think on that point, on the first, the transactional point, Trump certainly has to sell to his Make America Great Again base, his America First base, that he is not interested in foreign interventions, especially when it's spending taxpayer money. And worth noting, his vice president, J.D. Vance, who, again, seems influential in his latest talks. And it was Vance's university classmate, Dan Driscoll, who was initially involved in selling this plan to Ukraine. He has repeatedly said the U.S. border with Mexico is more important than Russia's border with Ukraine. But ultimately, I fear the answer may be as big and as small as just that Donald Trump does want that Nobel Peace Prize. He feels he has real momentum after what happened in Gaza. He took a victory lap after that, obviously hoping that the peace holds there. Now he thinks he can repeat the trick in Russia and Ukraine, and I think he wants the glory and the plaudits and ultimately the peace prize for that.
And of the amendments that we know of so far, what are the most significant ones that stand out to you?
I mean, this is, of course, this is all sort of based on media reporting, but I think not recognizing land seized by the Russian military is probably the most important in that. I mean, that original 28-point plan, many saw just as effectively Russian talking points. And in fact, there's even been controversy in Washington over whether it was, in fact, a Russian document and some confusion over that. But the idea that Russia would be rewarded for seizing land and, in fact, even given more land was, has struck many as outrageous and untenable for Zelensky. And I heard one former ambassador here predicting that, if Zelensky accepted that, he might face a coup within his own country. There would be such outrage in Ukraine. So I think the land issue is paramount. Just not rewarding Russian aggression, not rewarding the bully. I think, obviously the EU and NATO also significant, but that remains somewhat nebulous and in the long term anyway.
All right, David, thanks very much for that. David Smith, Washington Bureau Chief for The Guardian there. Also on the line, Suzanne Lynch, Brussels Bureau Chief for Bloomberg. Suzanne, looking at this from a European point of view, this 28-point plan was greeted with a degree of shock. Has anything changed over the weekend with those meetings in Geneva and those changes that David was outlining insofar as we know they are changes? Are there European fingerprints on that at all?
I think there certainly are European fingerprints on this plan or this revised plan as we now expect it to be. I mean, over the weekend, we saw a flurry of diplomacy. It was happening at the G20, which was taking place in South Africa. Donald Trump had snubbed that meeting, but a lot of the key European leaders, Emmanuel Macron, Keir Starmer, Friedrich Merz from Germany, were at that meeting, and they huddled on that on Saturday. And then this continued this morning at the EU Africa Summit in Angola with an emergency hybrid meeting of EU leaders. And of course, that meeting yesterday in Geneva, that seemed to have been key. Now, there were some European national security advisors in that meeting, including representatives of the European Commission and European Council. So, yes, I think the Europeans' perspective and their objective here was to try and influence Donald Trump and the White House on the details of this plan. And it looks so far, as David was saying there, we don't know the details, but it does look like, number one, that this 28-point plan has been whittled down to a 19-point plan. We're not sure what quite has been omitted at this stage, but now there is a new document that is now going to be the subject of discussion over the next few days. And I think the Europeans, there is a certain sense of relief that the worst has been avoided in terms of such that the maximalist position that was originally in this document appears now to have been watered down in some way.
Just to take a few of the points that seem to have changed, the idea of conceding territory that at the moment is still held by Ukraine to Russia in the Donbass, that would have been presumably a concern to Europeans because it would have seen a mass movement of Ukrainians out of those areas in advance of any Russian takeover.
Yes, I mean, these are parts of that area that Ukraine already holds. So why give that to Russia as part of a peace plan? And of course, Europe is worried that Russia will be able to kind of regroup, rearm, and use any position it might secure in the east of the country to launch attacks in the future on Ukraine or elsewhere. So that's obviously a big issue. Another specific concern that really alarmed the Europeans was there was a mention in the 28-point plan about this long-running plan to seize Russian immobilized assets. And the problem there was that in this 28-point plan, the Americans looked like they would lay claim in some way to some of these Russian assets, that these would be used as part of a US-led reconstruction plan in Ukraine
There's about 300 billion euro worth, is there?
There is, yeah. But the problem is that most of these are held in Europe. So would you have a situation where the Europeans take on the risk of tapping these assets for Russia as part of a loan to Ukraine, and then the US comes in and profits from that in some way? So this really did spark alarm in Brussels, and because the EU is trying to get that deal over the line. It's trying to encourage Belgium, where most of the assets are located, to sign up to this plan. But this has thrown a whole new dimension into things. But what we're hearing now is that this plan of US involvement in some kind of a plan to use these assets now appears to be off the table from what we're hearing at the moment. So that will be a source of relief for the Europeans also.
And there was seemingly concern over this idea of a generalised amnesty for war crimes, Russia's and also on the Ukrainian side as well. But on the Russian side of things, had an amnesty been granted, it would have undermined, it was being reported, the legal basis for retaining Russian assets and pursuing prosecutions on foot of war crimes, and indeed having a legal basis for sanctions as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's a lot of kind of international law at stake here. I mean, we've heard time and time again that this idea that a country can just come in and seize land and then it becomes their land, you know, that's undermining the principle of international law. Similarly with wartime accountability. And this Russian assets plan is based on the principle that Russia will be somehow held accountable ultimately to repay the damage or repay reparations to Ukraine. So a lot of kind of fundamental issues there in the wording of this initial document that the Europeans had concern with. Now, the key point, of course, hanging over all this, that even if a better plan, quote unquote, is agreed in terms of the European and Ukrainian perspective, we could have a situation where Washington will go to Moscow with this plan and Putin will say no to it and everything is back to square one. So even though the Europeans feel, I think it's fair to say, that they have bought some time at the moment, we still don't see here in Brussels, people don't still see a world in which Putin would sign up to this new plan as it stands, or as we're hearing it stands at the moment.
And finally and briefly, Suzanne, this meeting of the Coalition of the Willing, what will be discussed at their meeting tomorrow, and who'll be considered the heaviest players in the room?
Yeah, I think, again, Ukraine's main military backers here are the most important players here. We're talking about countries like Britain, increasingly Germany, which has increasingly upped its military help to Ukraine. We're also going to have a meeting of foreign ministers, EU foreign ministers, on Wednesday, a virtual meeting on this issue as well. So it speaks to the level of concern now and the panic that the Europeans are feeling, that they need to get ahead of this story. They need to get back into the narrative and into the conversation here. And the fact that these various meetings in different fora are taking place, I think, underlines that.
Thanks, Suzanne. Suzanne Lynch there, Brussels Bureau Chief of Bloomberg. And earlier we heard David Smith, Washington Bureau Chief for The Guardian.